This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Attorney General William Barr might be just the beginning. There is a growing list of President Trump's associates who could be charged with contempt of Congress if Democrats decide to go there. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi alluded to this yesterday.
When we're ready, we'll come to the floor. And we'll just see, because there might be some other contempt of Congress issues that we want to deal with at the same time.
Pelosi spoke one day after the House Judiciary Committee approved a resolution to hold the attorney general in contempt. A floor vote on that could come next week. Other names that have been floated to face the same consequence are former White House counsel Don McGahn and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, both for their noncompliance with requests for information from House Democrats. The Trump administration is holding firm in its current standoff with Congress. Something's got to give. What will it be? Joining us this week for the roundup is Carol Lee, a national political reporter for NBC News. Carol, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome.
Hey, Joshua.
And Juana Summers is a national political reporter with the Associated Press. Juana, glad to have you back.
Thanks so much.
White House versus Congress is where we're going to start and camp out for a little bit. There's this phrase that is likely to come up as we discuss the rift between the White House and Congress, and Carol Lee, maybe that's a good place to start, this phrase, constitutional crisis.
Right.
Based on what we've been talking about this week, what's our best definition of what a constitutional crisis is?
Well, essentially where one of the three branches of government is being neutered, so to speak. You know, we've heard the Speaker Pelosi say that we are in a constitutional crisis. Jerry Nadler said the same thing. We've seen other Democrats say we're more in a constitutional confrontation. And I think the reason for that is because while you have one branch of government, the executive branch, blocking another branch of government, Congress, from doing its oversight job, you still don't know. You still have the courts, which have not yet been brought into that process and could very well wind up being the referee. And I think there are some people who think that you can't actually really be in a constitutional crisis until you have a situation where the courts weigh in and the White House was to defy them.
So with all three branches of government being kind of in a gridlock instead of just two. All right. We'll talk about whether what's happening now amounts to a constitutional crisis in a bit. But let's begin with this contempt of Congress charge against the Attorney General, William Barr. Wanna talk about what the House Judiciary Committee decided this week regarding the Attorney General. They had held a very long, very long-winded hearing as well, in which they voted on whether or not to hold the AG in contempt of Congress. How did that turn out?
They did. That's absolutely right. And this came hours after the president asserted his executive privilege to shield the full report that special counsel Robert Mueller put together, and as well as the underlying evidence from Congress. This vote was taken after hours of debate, as you pointed, and it was the first vote we've seen to punish a government official in the standoff over the Mueller report. And the Trump Justice Department, notably, has said that this move was unnecessary. It was intended to stoke a fight. What I found really interesting is that this was a clear move by Democrats in the House that raised the stakes in the battle over this report as Democrats are investigating the president and his behavior as detailed by special counsel Robert Mueller in his report, which dug into the Russian election interference and possible obstruction of justice. And it seemed like this made very clear to me that this is likely the competing claims and this will be settled in the courts rather than on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, Reed Wilson, based on the fact that this may well end up in courts, how does this reflect on the Democratic strategy behind approving the contempt resolution?
Well, it's all about leverage. And what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is that the House Judiciary Committee has been negotiating with the Justice Department to try to obtain a less redacted form, well, an unredacted form of the Mueller report. The Justice Department offered to redact some of the information that they could. They say they can't redact all of it because it contains some grand jury stuff, which they basically would need the approval of a judge to release publicly. Those negotiations broke down. The Democrats said less redaction wasn't sufficient. They needed the full redaction plus the underlying evidence. That led to this standoff. So while the committee has approved the contempt resolution, Speaker Pelosi, as we heard in the clip, hasn't brought that to the floor yet because now negotiations get to continue to happen. And with the hope that this constitutional crisis, constitutional confrontation can be averted. And that's what we're seeing in a lot of the other potential contempt resolutions that would come up in various areas. I think it's we'd be remiss to point to miss pointing out that the House Intelligence Committee has issued their own subpoenas for the Mueller report. The Intelligence Committee has more jurisdiction over the foreign parts, at least, of the redactions within the Mueller report and the underlying evidence. And so that may be a new angle for Democrats to find the full report and eventually, of course, release it publicly.
So, Carol, what does this mean for William Barr? I mean, if this does not make it through the House vote, this doesn't go any further than just the Judiciary Committee, what's next? Was this worth it?
That's the key question, because, you know, the Democrats can take a bunch of these steps, but what really, to what end, what really happens? And is there accountability, and what does that necessarily look like? You know, the Attorney General yesterday was joking about being held in contempt at a ceremony for the outgoing Deputy Attorney General. He seemed to not be worried about it at all. You've heard, you know, Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, say that perhaps they could do things like fine people who are in contempt every day, and things like that. But that's the key question, and it's not clear. This is the second time this has happened. Former Attorney General Eric Holder was also held in contempt by the Republican House, and you know he continued to do his job. So, and the game here, or the calculation that both the White House and the Democrats are playing, is, you know, who's going to overreach. The White House wants to goad Democrats into overreaching, and Democrats want the president to overreach. And, you know, part of the reason why they may group a lot of these contempt votes into one is because, in part, you know, Democrats don't necessarily want to be seen as just constantly passing, contempt resolutions or whatever it is, because there's a risk of turning off voters in 2020.
Well, and that's what I was just going to ask you about, Juana, is the definition of overreaching, whether we're talking about overreaching legally in terms of what the Constitution allows with the separation of powers and Congress's ability to check the president, or whether we mean overreaching politically, where voters look at the way this plays out and goes, you're not governing, you're just catfighting, and I'm not going to vote for you next time.
Absolutely. And I think this is something I hear a lot on the campaign trail, frankly, is that there are some voters who want to hear what plans Democrats have to retake the White House at the ballot box rather than having these confrontations with the president all the time. There are some particularly moderate Democrats I talk to who are concerned that Democrats are missing the message when they're trying to figure out this more aggressive campaign to compel the president and his administration to comply with their investigations. And something I think will be that this is something that Democratic leaders, I think, are also having to be mindful of, right? You heard House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talk about this yesterday, where she discussed about building the case. And I think she made the point quite forcefully that this is a process. Impeachment isn't something she's going to rush to. They are building a case. They are doing the fact-finding part of their investigation right now and seeing what the facts lead them to. And I think that while she didn't say it directly, that there is certainly some of the politics of this have to be in mind for her and others in Washington.
Let me get to a few of your comments. One in particular, AC tweeted, Trump and Republicans would be wise to remember that they are setting a dangerous new precedent by backing Trump and encouraging him to ignore the powers of oversight of Congress. This goes both ways. Reid, what about the president's impact? There are other people who are being discussed as possible targets for contempt of Congress charges, former White House counsel Don McGahn, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. They are also in possession of documents that the Democrats want, the Treasury Secretary, the president's personal tax returns, and Don McGahn, a number of other documents related to the Russia investigation. What about the White House's role in all of this?
The White House has, they are asserting executive privilege for the first time since President Trump took office. And this is part of a sort of a 50 or 60 year history of power bleeding from the side of Pennsylvania Avenue where Congress sits to the White House, the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue. And that is something we've basically seen since Watergate. Every subsequent president takes a little more power for himself, makes the office a little more powerful at the expense of Congress, which again is supposed to be a co-equal branch. President Trump has now asserted this executive privilege in a way that no previous president has. So he's in effect trying to expand the office, the powers of his own office by exerting influence over, asserting executive privilege over something that goes beyond what the courts have traditionally ruled executive privilege is. It's funny that there is that he has asserted executive privilege over something that is sitting on bookshelves across the country and is in much of it is in the public domain. But that sets up this clash with Congress that again will be decided by the third branch of government. So we're in this place again where we have been with Obama and with Bush and with Clinton and with Bush, you know, all the way back, where at every turn a president tries to claw a little more power away from Congress. They usually have succeeded in the past. This is just a uniquely sort of new definition of what a president's powers through executive privilege may be.
We'll pick this up in just a minute, but Daniel wrote on our Facebook page, if we're not in a constitutional crisis, then what exactly would define one? We have government officials breaking the law and ignoring subpoenas. If ignoring black letter law and undermining the structure of government as defined in the Constitution isn't a crisis, then that word doesn't mean anything. It's an interesting point Daniel raises. Carol, I'd love you to respond to that when we come back. This idea that just the president's, you know, thumbing his nose at Congress and its oversight authority is enough to both find, you know, his lieutenants in contempt of Congress and to find him impeachable is another narrative that's come up. We'll get to that in a moment when we continue with NBC's Carol Lee, Reed Wilson of The Hill, and Juana Summers of The AP. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, NCR. NCR Silver is more than just a point of sale. It's like adding a business analyst that helps you drive profitability. It's an email marketing machine. Need a loyalty program? No problem. It's built in. NCR Silver was built to help make running small businesses easier. Adding new locations or new lanes? It's simple with NCR Silver. Big enterprise tools built for small business owners. NCR Silver. Visit ncr.com/silver.
About 10 minutes. That is all we need to get you started every morning. The biggest news stories from politics to pop culture with the analysis you need to understand what's happening. Listen to Up First, weekdays from NPR News.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup. Daniel wrote on our Facebook page, if we're not in a constitutional crisis, then what exactly would define one? We have government officials breaking the law and ignoring subpoenas. If ignoring black letter law and undermining the structure of government as defined in the Constitution isn't a crisis, then that word doesn't mean anything. Carol?
Yeah, I think, you know, right now, Democrats are at in this place where, particularly Democratic leadership, where they just want to take their time. They're not rushing to, as we heard Speaker Nancy Pelosi say yesterday, rushing towards impeachment and, you know, making this a five-alarm fire. However, you know, there is a real question about the president, the way that the president is responding to congressional oversight, in the sense that what's worth pointing out, it's not just that he's invoking executive privilege on the Mueller report, unredacted Mueller report and underlying documents. They have refused to turn over anything, to respond to any oversight, everything from security clearance process to child separation policy to tax returns. It's not just this one narrow thing. It's the very broad pushback and refusal to engage Congress in any way. And we haven't seen that before.
I'm glad Carol mentioned Robert Mueller. It seemed for a while like he might actually testify on the Russian investigation, that we might actually hear from him. There's still the matter of the full Mueller report. Where does that stand right now? Is Robert Mueller's testimony off the table, or is it in limbo, or where is that?
I'd probably categorize it as in limbo. We heard the president say that he believed that the attorney general should decide whether or not Robert Mueller testified, and that did little to diffuse any of the tensions between the White House and Democrats on the Hill, who say that this is just the latest example of how the president does not understand how the separation of power system works in the United States. They believe that it is up to the Congress, not the president and not the attorney general, to make that determination. So we'll see if that actually comes to fruition. But I don't States. I don't expect that House Democrats will be dropping the ball on that anytime soon. And they will continue to feel an urgency to ask him to come in and testify.
There was also another congressional subpoena that made news this week, and that was for the president's son, Donald Trump Jr. The president, Donald Trump Sr., reacted to the news of the subpoena this way.
Well, I was very surprised. I saw Richard Burr saying there was no collusion 2 or 3 weeks ago. He went outside and somebody asked him, no, there's no collusion. We found no collusion. But I was very surprised to see my son. My son's a very good person, works very hard. The last thing he needs is Washington, D.C. He could rather not ever be involved.
That's the president speaking about the congressional subpoena regarding his son. Reed, give us a sense of what that's all about, particularly because the committee that issued the subpoena is the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is led by a Republican.
By a Republican, which is what has been the most remarkable about this particular subpoena. That's the Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr and the Vice Chair Mark Warner, who's a Democrat from Virginia, issued this subpoena because apparently talks between the committee and Don Jr. broke down over whether or not he would come in and actually testify. And this comes out of Michael Cohen's testimony before Congress, in which he said that Don Jr. had told the president about the planned meeting with some Russian operatives who were eventually promising dirt on Hillary Clinton back in Trump Tower. And it also revolves around the Trump organization's plans or hopes to build a tower in Moscow at some point. The committee wants to square that with Don Jr.'s earlier statement that he did not, in fact, inform President Trump, then candidate Trump, about the potential meeting. There is some inconsistency between what Michael Cohen says, what Donald Jr. says, and that has led to this subpoena. It has also led to some serious backlash within the Republican Party directed at Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr. This subpoena was apparently issued a couple of weeks ago, but it broke. The news about it broke the day after Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that the case on the Russian investigation was closed. Well, now suddenly it looks like it's reopened again. And the scorn heaped on Richard Burr from his colleagues, not only members of the House of Representatives, but also his fellow senators, which is pretty unusual for Republican senators to rebuke another Republican senator, and also from Tom Tillis, the senator from North Carolina, Richard Burr's seatmate. Burr has a little bit of independence here because he's not running for re-election when he's up in 2022. On the other hand, Tillis is. And Don Jr. has become a very popular surrogate on the Republican campaign trail. He's been out there everywhere. He's got a lot of allies in the Senate, but there's no indication that Senator Richard Burr is going to back down.
You mentioned that Mitch McConnell said that this is case closed with regards to the Russia investigation. One more story, Carol, that caught our eye had to do with this letter signed by hundreds of former federal prosecutors who would suggest that the case is only really closed because Donald Trump happens to be the president right now. They collectively concluded that were he not the president, he would be charged with obstructing justice. When it was first published, more than 400 attorneys from Democratic and Republican administrations were signatories to the letter. As of the moment, there are more than 800, so it's more than doubled since it first came out. It reads in part, quote, "Each of us believes that the conduct of President Trump described in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report would, in the case of any other person not covered by the Office of Legal Counsel policy against indicting a sitting president, result in multiple felony charges for obstruction of justice," unquote. Now, Carol, last night CNN did a town hall with James Comey, the former director of the FBI. They asked him about this very thing, and he said that there were, in his words, no doubt that Donald Trump would be prosecuted for this. And I get that. But I think there are still a lot of Americans who are like, can we just close this case already? Like, can we either arrest him or don't? Either prosecute him or don't? Either let us get the 2020 election over with or don't? But get us out of limbo.
Yeah, and that's, you hit on a really important point there, because I think a lot of people had this impression that the Mueller report would be definitive and, you know, everyone could have a clear answer and move on. And that's not the case. And we're back basically where we've been during the investigation, which is where one side feels one thinks one way and then the other side, thinks another way. This question, though, about whether or not the president is sort of above the law is a really interesting one, in the sense that that's a remarkable letter, and the number of people who signed on to it and who are from both parties. And, you know, I think when you, the other part of that is that you also had the attorney general say essentially that you couldn't charge with obstruction because there was no underlying crime. That's a whole other dimension of that raises new questions, because I think a lot of prosecutors will tell you that that's not how they view that process. And then, you know, you also have, there's a Trump's legal team floated their theory that the president couldn't obstruct justice because it just wasn't capable of doing that because he's the president. So all of this, I think, is to a lot of voters noise. And what's unclear is how much of the voters in the middle, the ones who matter, who are going to be decisive in this election, what's who they're going to side with on this. And that largely depends on how the, you know, Republicans and the Democrats message on it. And we just don't know yet.
One last comment, Juana, before we move on from this. Tom writes, Congress has too many leaks. They cannot be trusted with secure information. This is why the White House is holding back information. Juana, that may be true, but I don't think that argument would have worked for, say, the Watergate tapes.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think that that's why what you heard yesterday from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was so strong. She made very clear that this is going to be a methodical, fact-based process, that she's not going to be pushed by anyone's impulses to rush to any sort of judgment, and that they need to take the time to figure out what exactly happened. And that's why compelling folks to testify on Capitol Hill and to turn over those documents that so far this administration has been reticent to turn over is so important and powerful. And I think that's why you'll see the impulses of Democrats and those on Capitol Hill to continue to get these investigations going is so important.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this ongoing confrontation, crisis, catfight thing, whatever it is. But for now, let's move on to a story that came out of the New York Times this week. It was an investigation into Donald Trump's taxes, not his personal tax returns, but his business taxes, the taxes of his companies. It revealed more than $1 billion in losses between 1985 and 1994, so about a decade's worth from the 80s to 90s. Now, the report is drawing some questions around the health of his business dealings. Reed Wilson, I'm not sure how impressed to be with this. I don't think the idea that the Donald Trump business empire lost money is new. We've known that about his dealings in New York. We definitely knew that about his casino dealings in Atlantic City, the airline that he ran, some of his dealings in Vegas. Like, we've known for a long time that Donald Trump has lost money. And these aren't the tax returns, you know, I hate to sound all Jedi on you, but these aren't the tax returns you're looking for. What is the point of this article?
Well, the thing that I think is new here is the scope of the losses. We're talking about more than $1.2 billion over the course of about a decade, and a decade in which the American economy was booming, in which everybody was making money hand over fist, at least at that sort of scale that President Trump was at, or then private citizen Donald Trump was at. And I think it's also fascinating to pay attention to the way the New York Times talked about their sourcing. They do not, in fact, have the tax returns. They have the numbers that correspond to the lines that would go on a tax return, which effectively allows them to rebuild what his tax return would look like.
That part where it says, add up line 22 with line 48, well, put in line 53,
They've got a number that says that, you know, $100 million goes on line 17. So you don't have the form, but you know that $100 million goes in the box that says 17. And that tells you something about where these numbers came from and whether or not basically this isn't, nobody sent them the hard copies of the tax returns, but that indicates that these numbers probably come from some interaction between the IRS and a bank that President Trump did business with. And it sheds a little light on why President Trump is suing Deutsche Bank and some other firms to keep his information private, despite the fact that they have been subpoenaed by Congress.
Carol, this feels like the kind of thing that could play directly to conservatives, to Republicans who say, see, this is more proof that the Democrats, the liberal media will not leave Donald Trump alone. They're so thirsty looking for blood in the water that they'll dump it in the water if they have to. This is exactly why we hate the media, the Democrats. This is exactly why I am solidly behind Donald Trump. This feels like perfect fodder for that argument.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also the kind of thing that I think, you know, while there are some details that we learned that are new, this is baked into the cake for Donald Trump. I mean, every voters knew this about him. They voted for him anyway. In fact, some of this, including, you know, using loopholes and ways to get out of paying taxes, it was part of his whole shtick during the campaign, that he knows how to get around these. He's been getting around these loopholes forever, and he's going to go and fix the system that he took advantage of. You know, the part that could wind up hurting him with this narrative is, you know, one of the facts that came out in the New York Times story is that while he was, wrote The Art of the Deal, his famous book, he was losing a ton of money. And, you know, that's not something that people would expect, because he campaigned on being this great deal maker and businessman. If he can't get a deal with China, for instance, on, you know, trade, or he can't get the new NAFTA through Congress, you know, all of these promises that people who voted for him were relying on when they did that, if he both is known to not be to have a, you know, checkered background in terms of his ability to run his own business, and then can't get the deals done that he promised to do, that's where this sort of narrative will hurt him in 2020.
Let me get to two of your comments about the president's taxes before we keep going. Joe wrote on our Facebook page, he knows how to take advantage of the tax loopholes for his own benefit, like most other wealthy people. Sadly, the new GOP tax law seems to have added more of these types of breaks for the wealthy instead of reducing them. Amos writes, I am just a working class person, and I want to know when Congress is going to do what they were elected to do instead of pushing and pushing against the president. Let's move out of the Beltway now to two states in the South, which might be advancing the debate over abortion laws in the U.S. There are two pieces of legislation that are more than likely going to be challenged in the courts, maybe up to the Supreme Court. One of them is in Georgia. It was a bill that was signed into law by Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia. He signed what's been referred to as the heartbeat bill. Give us a sense of what this so-called heartbeat bill does.
So a heartbeat bill is a bill that passes as a ban on abortion after a doctor can detect what they call a fetal heartbeat in the womb, which is usually about 6 weeks, which is before most women would know that they're pregnant. And this is part of a trend. We saw this had happened in Georgia, but there are 16 states actually that have either passed or are trying to pass these types of bans on abortion. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing that is because conservative governors and legislators are really pushing this to try to get abortion back in front of what they see as one of the most friendly Supreme Courts in decades. And they really want to see that fight happen. And we saw separately the vote in Alabama, of course, to vote on what could be one of the nation's strictest abortion laws that's been proposed recently.
Reed?
So this is part of a new trend in the anti-abortion movement away from what had been their sort of strategy over the last decade, which was to restrict abortions at the margins. That is, put added restrictions on clinics that would force some clinics to close, require waiting periods, require outside counseling. That's sort of around the edges. After Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court, the entire movement completely changed their approach because of what Juana said. They now have the friendliest Supreme Court that they've ever had on abortion. Kavanaugh replaced Anthony Kennedy, who was a supporter of at least the protections for some abortion rights. And now what they are pursuing are these basically outright bans. The Alabama example that's being debated right now came to a grinding halt yesterday because some Republican legislators wanted to strip out exemptions for even cases of rape and incest.
I should note, by the way, Reed, sorry to interrupt, but it got so high on the Senate floor, it did devolve into a shouting match. Here's part of what you would have heard.
All those in favor say aye.
No.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Committee amendment is tabled.
Senator
Chambliss.
There was no motion. There was no motion.
There was a motion. He made a motion.
He didn't even make a motion, Mr. President.
Hold on. Excuse me.
He did not make a motion.
He made a motion to table.
He did not make a motion. There was no motion for no.
So that's what it sounded like in the Alabama State House.
Yeah, and this is what we've seen. There have been 9 states since Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed that have passed so-called trigger laws that would ban abortion the moment the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. That's the entire strategy here. Get one of these bills in front of the Supreme Court.
I want to pick up, Carol, with whether this strategy is sound. I mean, just because a Supreme Court leans in one particular direction doesn't mean it's going to rule in that direction. I want to talk a little bit more about that when we get back. We'll get to some more of your comments as well. Aaron wrote on our website, good God, have these legislators even talked to a doctor? Reimplantation of an ectopic pregnancy isn't a thing. A sentence of 99 years in prison for an abortion? Laws about abortion weren't this severe before Roe v. Wade was decided. We'll get to that in a moment. As we pause, you might have noticed that NPR's Morning Edition got a new theme this week. It also found a fan in Conan O'Brien. He composed some new lyrics to the theme, which he debuted last night on his late night show on TBS. Give it a listen. See what you think. Stay close.
We're NPR News. It's na-na-na-na-na-na-na-news. You get up and you're out of bed. Look at the world and you scratch your head.
Support also comes from Rothy's. Rothy's are the everyday flats for life on the go. Stylish, versatile, fully machine washable, and they go with everything from yoga pants to dresses and skirts. Best of all, there's zero break-in period thanks to their woven design, seamlessly crafted from recycled water bottles. Plus, Rothy's always come with free shipping and free returns and exchanges. Find out why BuzzFeed called them their forever shoes at rothys.com/1A.
What would you do if you found out a story that had shaped your identity was a lie? NPR's new podcast, White Lies, investigates a murder in Selma, Alabama from 1965.
And exposes the conspiracy that kept it unsolved. Until now. White Lies. Start listening Tuesday.
Back now to the roundup with Juana Summers, Carol Lee, and Reed Wilson. Carol, let's pick up with that comment about the Supreme Court, or that notion about the Supreme Court. It doesn't seem like a slam dunk with regards to what the abortion ruling was. John Roberts was the Chief Justice when the Obamacare ruling came down. A number of justices that Richard Nixon were on the Supreme Court when they ruled unanimously that he had to turn over the Watergate tapes. So it doesn't historically feel like a slam dunk, but this country's in a different place right now.
Yeah, it is in a different place. And as we were talking about earlier, anti-abortion activists feel that the court has not been this much potentially in their favor in a really long time. But we've also seen where some of these where these abortion issues will go to the Supreme Court, and the ruling doesn't go in the way that anti-abortion activists want it to. So it's a risk, but it's not a risk in the sense that they still get to push the issue, which is a very politically, it's a lightning rod issue politically, and it's something that obviously stokes passions on both sides. You know, the way that things are unfolding in Alabama and in Georgia does give some of the more moderate Republicans make them uncomfortable. This is not something that the entire party is embracing. And in fact, if you're just looking at it politically, I think there were Republicans who thought that Democrats, that they could use this issue against Democrats in the campaigns, because there were certain laws, particularly in New York, that Republicans thought went too far in terms of abortion. And now you see the pendulum swinging to the other side. And so potentially, you know, Democrats could use that in the election against them. So it's not a slam dunk at all in the Supreme Court, and it's also very uncertain how it would play politically.
Let me get to some of your comments about these abortion laws. Barbara in St. Louis emailed, if a heartbeat determines that a fetus is a person, will the fetuses of undocumented immigrants be persons and therefore citizens? Nicholas tweeted, will Georgia also be allowing women to file for child support at 6 weeks or require fathers that don't want to be involved to cover the costs of the pregnancy? Another listener writes, our children are being shot in a place they should feel safe, yet our politicians don't move to change laws to help stop people from getting these high-powered weapons. They seem too busy passing laws to restrict a woman's right to an abortion. Why do these politicians seem more concerned with a tiny zygote and not our actual children? That might be a good place to shift to another story outside the Beltway that caught the whole nation's attention. And sadly, it came not just the fact that it came, but also that it was just a few weeks after the 20th anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting in Littleton, Colorado. This week, there was another school shooting just a few miles away from Columbine. It was at the STEM school Highlands Ranch, which is in the Denver area. 9 students were shot on Tuesday, 1 student shot dead. The 2 suspects are students in custody. They'll face charges today. Juana Summers, there's a lot that we still don't quite know about the narrative of all this, but have we learned anything about who these students are, why the shooting happened, or is it still kind of early going?
I think it's still really early going. The one thing that we do know quite clearly is that the young man that was killed was the latest evidence we have of a student sacrificing themselves, because we see students repeatedly, again and again, twice in the last 2 weeks, being really on the front lines of fighting off gunmen in schools in our country. I think that's really struck a nerve with a lot of people.
His name was Kendrick Castillo.
Absolutely. And we heard that. And we also heard, I was watching CNN and heard the powerful interview with a young man, the 12-year-old, who was saying he was hiding in a closet with a baseball bat in his hand because if he was going to die, he wanted to go down fighting. And I think that hearing these students talk about how it's not about cowering behind a desk or hiding, but they're thinking about how to fight and how to save their lives as well as their classmates' lives, I think has really struck an accord with a lot of parents across the country and a lot of people who think that, frankly, lawmakers have let these students down.
Yeah, Reed Wilson, there's the common phrase that law enforcement is using now, run, hide, fight, if you're ever in an active shooter situation, meaning your first recourse in any active shooter situation should be to run, get as far away as fast as possible. If you cannot run, find some place to hide, barricade yourself in, because shooters tend to go room to room looking opportunistically and not necessarily searching unless they're searching for one person. And if all else fails, prepare yourself to fight back. This feels like it runs right up to policy, especially now that some states like Florida have passed laws that allow teachers to be armed in classrooms if they so desire.
Yeah, actually, I had lunch with my old college roommate yesterday who is a teacher in Florida, and he was telling me about some of the conversations that he's had with his colleagues about whether or not to carry a weapon, and he's not going to, but there are more and more states now that are allowing not only guns in the classroom, but also allocating a bunch of money to secure schools. That's been sort of the answer to this the epidemic of school shootings that take place in red states, particularly. Even in California, Governor Gavin Newsom just put $15 million in his budget to increase security at mosques and synagogues after the synagogue shooting out there a couple of weeks ago. And I mean, it strikes me that the run, hide, fight is similar to the new approach taken to hijacked airplanes, where in the 70s and 80s, a hijacked airplane was the approach was just sort of let the terrorists land and make their demands. Well, now their goal might not be to land, and the fact that we're equating living in schools or going to school with a terrorism situation is a really sad statement on what is happening in the country right now.
Carol?
It's also a statement on just the lack of leadership and abilities for elected officials to do anything on this issue. This is something where you can see you're in a situation now. I'm a parent. My son does at his school. They do active shooter drills. This is a routine thing. You know, some people do them for tornadoes. The schools do them for an active shooter. So you see this whole patchwork of where people are trying to take this into their own hands and figure out how to manage a situation that continues to happen across the country in different schools. And while Congress and lawmakers are in a bit completely deadlocked on being able to do anything, and we've seen that in tragedies, where there are far, far many more deaths at a school where young children are gunned down in schools. And so I guess in terms of any of that changing, it would really require this to become a voting issue, and particularly for Democrats, which it hasn't been in the way it has been for Republicans in terms of gun rights. And maybe this next generation will be the generation that does that.
Well, you know, Juana, that's the funny thing, is because there was a vigil for the victims of the shooting on Wednesday evening, and it ended in protest because students said that Democratic politicians who spoke at the event were basically politicizing their trauma. Which is interesting because after the shooting in Parkland, Florida at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, those students politicized it themselves.
Right.
They formed March for Our Lives. They are still wildly politically active and absolutely fearless. So it's almost like the path to doing something about school shooting is more nuanced now than it ever has been.
Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right that that was the choice of the students in Florida. They decided that they wanted to make this a political issue, and they saw it as imperative to their survival, quite frankly, that they do so. But these students in Colorado, they said they wanted their classmate who was slain fighting for his life and others' lives to be remembered. And they, frankly, felt like the politicians and folks who spoke were intruding on that space where they wanted to remember and to mourn. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how candidates, particularly on the campaign trail running for president in 2020, handle this. They have been outspoken on the issue of gun violence. Most of them have spoken up in some way about this shooting, about some of the others that we've seen this year alone. But threading that needle, I think, will be really nuanced and difficult for them as to how to both speak to those folks who feel like this is a political imperative to address this, as well as to those who maybe aren't necessarily, who are survivors who aren't necessarily seeking that themselves.
And Reed, there's also been a kind of a changing perception of the NRA in the last few months. There's been reporting about internal issues at the NRA, financial problems. Oliver North was pushed out as president just recently in what has been reported as a spat with the executive VP, Wayne LaPierre. So the whole scope of gun legislation and Second Amendment advocacy, it feels less certain than ever before, at least to me.
Well, it's becoming an actual political issue that is something of a fairer fight than it has been in the past. And that's because of the troubles that the NRA is going through, coupled with the fact that the pro-gun control movement, if you will, has been better funded in the last few years than it ever has been before. It's more organized sort of around two groups, one run by former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, the other run by Mike Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, both of whom are raising tens of millions of dollars, spending that money on candidates, and talking about gun safety. I think they've moved away from the control word and towards safety in a way that they haven't before. So the argument has gone from a debate over whether or not Democrats in rural areas will ever back gun control to a question of whether or not Republicans are going to start peeling off. The Democratic Party is more united around gun safety, gun control legislation. We've seen some very aggressive pushes from Senator Cory Booker, who just laid out a big agenda item this week, and pretty much every 2020 Democrat is going to be more friendly towards gun control than any Democratic nominee going back 20 or 30 years.
Although it's interesting, a number of these student movements have said, we'll take this money, but not that money. Like, we don't need your big dollars to do what we're doing. We can do it without your help.
Yeah.
Let's talk business for a moment, especially Facebook. Its co-founder, Chris Hughes, has said that the government should break Facebook up. That's what one of the co-founders of Facebook said. Hughes talked to NPR's Morning Edition about why he thinks the social media giant needs more regulation.
What used to be a little startup, a story of American entrepreneurship, has become a leviathan. I mean, the company is worth nearly $500 billion. And most importantly, Mark Zuckerberg is unaccountable. He's unaccountable to his shareholders. He's unaccountable to his users. And he's unaccountable to government. And I think that that's fundamentally un-American, and I think government should step up, break up the company, and regulate it.
That's Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes speaking on NPR's Morning Edition. Carol, the federal government has a mixed record in terms of breaking up big companies. You know, AT&T was broken up, and now it's kind of reformed. Movie studios were broken up from the cinemas that showed their films. That seems to have stuck. Newspapers broken up, TV and radio conglomerates broken up, and they've kind of trickled back together. I wonder if government in its current form is even able to break up Facebook.
Yeah, it sounds a lot easier than it actually is to accomplish. You know, and one of the things that he's proposing is that they create a new agency to regulate the tech industry, which is interesting because the tech industry is kind of this thing that seems to have snuck up on lawmakers and regulators in the sense that it's been allowed to expand, grow. It has its tentacles in all of our lives, every aspect of our lives, in ways that we still don't even fully understand. And now there's this recognition, particularly after the way that it was used by the Russian government to interfere in the 2016 election, there's this effort to try to kind of go back and fix it and see what can be done about it. One of the questions now is it too late? How do you do that? Is it already too big? And there are questions about, you know, Facebook, for instance, and its way it operates over in countries overseas. And it's just, it's become this massive kind of behemoth, and how they get their arms around it is totally unclear, and it's not clear they're up for the job.
Another big company that's getting bigger, including today, is Uber. There were rideshare drivers who went on strike Wednesday, a few days ahead of the IPO, which was this morning. The IPO landed about $82 billion. It started trading this morning. Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi rang the opening bell in New York on the stock exchange floor. Juana Summers, I wonder not only just how big a deal Uber is, but also how much power the drivers have. They seem to be trying to get more, but it's questionable as to whether or not it's too late at this point. Uber's too big.
Absolutely. And we saw almost most of the 2020 Democrats who are running for president line up behind these striking drivers ahead of this IPO today. What I think is going to be really interesting is whether or not investors will buy into the vision of this company, which, as the Washington Post and others have reported, is bleeding billions annually on operations. This also comes on the heels of an IPO for Lyft, which offers virtually the same services. And that was not a huge splash. So we'll see what happens there.
A few more quick stories we wanted to mention before we go. One regarding CBS. The network is shifting from firing high-profile men to elevating women into higher profiles. This week, the network announced that CBS This Morning co-host Nora O'Donnell will become the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. Her co-host John Dickerson will join 60 Minutes, so Gail King will now be the morning show's marquee host. These changes come from the new president of CBS News, Susan Zirinsky. She is the division's first female president. If you saw that movie Broadcast News, Zirinsky inspired Holly Hunter's character. In recent years, CBS fired three high-profile men over sexual harassment accusations: morning host Charlie Rose, 60 Minutes executive producer Jeff Fager, and the CEO of the CBS Corporation, Les Moonves. Finally, before we go, we love stories about music, and New York neighborhoods have seen a lot of rebranding lately, sometimes with mixed responses. But Staten Island residents seem to be happy with a change to one neighborhood there. Shorty's running wild, smoking cess, drinking beer, and ain't trying to hear what I'm kicking in his ear. Neglected for now, but yo, it got to be accepted. That what? The life is hectic. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. A corner of the borough has now been named the Wu-Tang Clan District, in honor of the influential hip-hop group. Other New York streets are set to be named after the Notorious B.I.G. and Woody Guthrie. Juana Summers, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Juana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Thanks, Reed. And NBC national political reporter Carol Lee. Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital crew is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. This is 1A. Cash moves everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Today, the Trump administration made good on its promise to sharply raise tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports. China says it will retaliate. Tensions are also growing between the U.S. and North Korea. The U.S. seized a North Korean freighter caught violating U.N. sanctions. This came after Pyongyang fired two short-range missiles. Also, mixed messages from the Trump administration on Iran, the nomination of a new U.S. defense secretary, the latest on Venezuela, and the fate of two journalists imprisoned in Myanmar. Joining us for this hour here in studio is Moises Naim, a distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the chief international columnist at the newspaper El País. Moises, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is NBC national security and military reporter Courtney Kuby. Courtney, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And joining us from Beijing is David Rennie, the Economist's Beijing bureau chief. David, glad to have you with us.
Hello.
Let's begin with China. The U.S. has officially raised tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. President Trump says the U.S. will also start to tax virtually all imports from China.
So our country can take in $120 billion a year in tariffs, paid for mostly by China, by the way, not by us. A lot of people try and steer it in a different direction. It's really paid, ultimately, it's paid for by largely by China. And businesses will pour back into our country. So instead of making the product, it'll be the old-fashioned way, the way we used to do it. We made our own product.
That was President Trump speaking yesterday. Even a high-profile meeting between Chinese and American officials could not prevent this crackdown. David Rennie, let me start with you. Because the U.S. and China had been working their way towards a trade deal, what made it fall apart?
Well, a couple of things. In the short term, the Chinese came back and clearly thought that Donald Trump was going to cave. And so they came back and came with a deal where they basically abandoned a lot of the promises that they had made. And the Americans basically thought, hang on, at the 11th hour, this deal is falling apart and you're reneging on things. But I think there's a bigger problem, too, which is that the real demands that the Trump administration have been making are that China should change the way that it does capitalism, that it shouldn't have a state-controlled economy, that it shouldn't subsidize national champions, and that it should treat American companies exactly the same way as Chinese companies and should put that into Chinese law so that America can sue the Chinese if they don't keep those promises. And that was, sitting here in Beijing, very few people thought that that was actually realistically anything that any Chinese government was going to be able to give Donald Trump.
What's some of the other reaction been like, David, to this standoff in China and officially to the new tariffs?
So it's getting suddenly pretty nasty. There's been a real sort of phony war sense here, because remember, we've had these tariffs since September at the 10% level. And, you know, that stung a bit. But a lot of Chinese people thought that it probably hurt America more than it was going to hurt China. The Chinese government thought that it was very clever in the way that it put retaliatory tariffs on kind of Trump's favorite voters. So you saw things like soybeans being hit with a Chinese tariff, which was designed to make farmers in places like Iowa kind of cry out in pain. And the Chinese were pretty sure that that would bring Donald Trump to heel. They also notice Donald Trump tweeting about the stock market. They're not stupid. They realize that Donald Trump cares a lot about things like the stock market and the idea that he's running a good economy. So I think the Chinese for a long time thought that Donald Trump would do a fairly easy deal and that they'd be able to buy their way out of this. But that calculation's gone completely wrong. And what's very interesting today, now it's gone to 25%, is we've had this strange phenomenon here where, which you can call kind of liberals for Trump. If you talked to reformist economists and people who really thought that China needs to do some of these reforms, until very, very recently, they were like almost egging Donald Trump on. It was like, we probably can't pull these reforms off on our own, but a bit of pressure from Donald Trump might be just what we need. Today, with this very aggressive feeling 25% tariff, those voices are quiet. You now see this real sense of kind of national indignation and a sense of kind of China rallying around the flag that China is under attack. And I think this could get quite ugly if this negotiation doesn't go in a much more sort of constructive direction very, very soon.
Yeah, you mentioned the farmers who are in the middle of this tariff fight. President Trump this morning tweeted, among other things, quote, "Your all-time favorite president got tired of waiting for China to help out and start buying from our farmers, the greatest anywhere in the world," unquote. Moises Naim, give us a sense of what other industries are caught in the middle of this struggle over tariffs.
A lot of them, when you impose tariffs on $200 billion and then threaten to increase it to the rest, which is at $325 billion more, you are in a point in which the average tariff to the United States is 7.5%. That is higher than the average tariff in developing countries that are trying to protect their industries in order to make them grow. And so you have, when you get to that point and that scale of tariffs, you hit the garments, you hit electronics, you hit all kinds of industries, toys and everything, and they're hitting at significantly the growth of the United States. Moody Analytics, for example, calculates that these tariffs will pair by 0.8% the GDP growth of the United States. So the president is comfortable because he has a very strong economy, growth, economic growth is high, unemployment is low, investment is beginning to happen. So, you know, he's confident, but he's playing with fire because these tariffs can undermine the strength and the health of the U.S. economy.
And could we just be clear, Moises, the president is saying that China will pay the cost of these tariffs. That's not true, is it?
No, it's not true. And what happens with trade always is that the pain is highly concentrated and the benefits are widely dispersed. So the tariffs, you know, what he claims is they're paying us in order to export to the United States, and that money is coming into the United States. Well, it's coming to the U.S. Treasury. Meanwhile, soybean producers that have seen their volumes of exports plummeting to almost nothing are hurting. And it's very interesting how strategic the Chinese have been in targeting what kinds of tariffs, because they are retaliating. This is a trade war. You tariff my exports, and I do the same to you. And so the Chinese have been very strategic in pinpointing and selecting the kinds of products that will hurt the president most in politics. You know, all of the agricultural sector is going to be significantly impacted by this.
And it's interesting how much the country, Courtney, is now paying attention to this, not just farmers and, you know, people who work in science and technology and agriculture. It's affecting many parts of the, you know, the manufacturing sector. You know, he went after Harley Davidson at one point a few months ago, which is still kind of a talking point. By the way, for those of you who are Harley owners like myself, there's part of the VIN that you can read that will tell you where your bike was made. So don't panic. You can research that yourself. But I do wonder, Courtney, in terms of what this means going forward. I mean, China means a lot to the U.S. for more than just the tariff talks. China, you know, wants to be the next big superpower. Mm-hmm. What does this mean in context?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't forget about the fact that the U.S., I mean, from an economic standpoint, you have the world's two largest economies. And if, in fact, the United States continues to move towards China really as an adversary, as an enemy, you think about how entangled the economies are between these two nations and what that could actually mean. But, you know, the timing of all this is also fascinating, given that we just had these two launches from North Korea. The U.S. needs China to rein in and put pressure on North Korea to bring them back to the table, to convince them to denuclearize, to convince them to stop these tests, to bring them back to the negotiating table, which as we all know, in Hanoi, fell apart, those diplomatic relations. I thought David made a really fascinating point when he was talking about how the Chinese thought, you know, that President Trump was going to fall. What we have here is President Xi Jinping and President Trump, who both see themselves as these master strategists, but they approach these situations from very different perspectives. President Trump, he can change his mind on a whim, and he is very vocal about it. What with the tweets? We've seen, I don't even know how many tweets about this morning, about the trade talks.
Quite a few, yeah.
President Xi approaches it, and the Chinese approach it from a very different perspective. It's not uncommon for late in negotiations with the Chinese for things to get bumpy and rocky, but for them to completely fall apart so quickly like this, that is very concerning. They're meeting again, you know, today, Friday, to try to bring some kind of conclusion to this. But, you know, if in fact this does not, they don't reach some kind of an agreement, this will have just wide-ranging repercussions, both for the Chinese economy and the United States economy, and then the world beyond that.
Some mixed opinions about this whole China standoff. Tom wrote on our Facebook page, check the Made In label, like we're really going to push China around. Charlie wrote on our Facebook page, thank you, President Trump, for fighting to put America first. Randall in Michigan emailed, what would happen if China stopped buying American debt? James, with regards to the U.S. and China, James emailed, the Trans-Pacific Partnership would have been an extremely effective tool in dealing with China right now. Too bad POTUS bailed on it. Moises, as I recall, China was not a direct signatory to the TPP. If I'm remembering correctly, and you would know better than I would, the idea was that the partnership would create more leverage in bringing China to heel on things like not stealing intellectual property. But how do you see it? Would it have made a difference?
is up. The caller is absolutely the person who wrote the email is absolutely right. If we had the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Agreement, this situation would have been very different, because that agreement would have included something between 40% and 50% of the global economy, and China was explicitly excluded. And therefore, it's very different when you negotiate just go it alone, that and not if you are part of this huge, very important, and carefully crafted agreement that was ignored and essentially then reneged by President Trump. The other point that it's worth mentioning is that the complaints that the world has with China have nothing to do with tariffs. They are about the theft of intellectual property, the harassment of foreign companies, the exclusion, and the difficulties of foreign companies to operate in China, and all kinds of 21st century challenges. There are cybernetic, there are digital, and many other, and intellectual property. And they are dealing with this with tariffs. Tariffs are a 15th century kind of tool, and trying to deal with 21st century challenges.
All right, let's move on to the ongoing standoff between the U.S. and North Korea. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is calling for what he described as full combat posture after a series of missile test launches. Yesterday, North Korea launched two short-range missiles, according to South Korean officials, and the U.S. recently seized a North Korean cargo vessel. Courtney Cuby, let's start with those missiles, those objects, whatever they were, that North Korea said were a routine and self-defensive military drill. What do we know about this launch?
So, I mean, we know a little bit from the South Koreans. The U.S. has not been very forthcoming with information on it. We know it was at least two short-range ballistic missiles. It could have been more than that. If you look at the pictures that the North Koreans released, it looks like they launched off four, but they frequently Photoshop, so it's hard to know if that's true. They were ballistic missiles. They didn't travel far. They landed in the water, in the ocean, you know, disturbed some fish, but they weren't actually a threat to anyone on land. What's concerning about this, though, is they appear to be solid fuel rockets, which North Korea has used before, but it indicates an ability to quickly establish a rocket and launch it. If it's a liquid fuel, just think about it. It takes time to actually gas it up. You know, it's that simple.
You have to fill a tank.
You have to fill a tank, and that takes some time, and that gives the United States and other places an opportunity to see what they're doing and have an idea that they might launch something off. Another thing, another concerning point about the launch specifically on Thursday is they seem very similar, these missiles, to a Russian-made Iskander rocket or missile, which has the ability to make a course correction midair, which means it can move and or it can turn midair, mid-flight, and theoretically evade ballistic missile defenses. If, in fact, that's what it is, that's a new and concerning development. We don't know for sure because, again, we're not getting a lot of information out of the U.S. on this, and I think that's due in large part to the fact that there is so much concern about what this means for diplomacy. This is one of, you know, the three tenets that President Trump has pointed to as why things are going well with diplomacy. You know, they're not launching, they're working towards denuclearization, and they're repatriating remains of U.S. service members, all of which have made steps towards completely moving in the opposite direction just in the last week or two.
And I'm sure, Courtney, that the South Koreans are probably spitting mad over this.
They seem to be, but it's funny. You know, I've been covering this for 14 years now, and so there's a pattern for what happens when North Korea launches a missile in the response. It's generally, if it's a short range, if it's not a threat, the U.S. military puts out a response. If it's something that goes a little further, maybe into the Japanese economic zone or something, then it tends to elevate maybe to the Pentagon. And if, in fact, it's something like an ICBM, the White House, the administration really gets involved. These were short range. You know, the tests on Saturday, last Saturday, they were essentially high-end artillery. It was not really, it wasn't a threat to anyone, but we're getting very little information out of the United States, and the stuff that's coming out of the South Koreans is actually in some ways conflicting with the information we're getting out of the United States. So the response here shows just how seriously the United States and South Korea are taking this, how concerned they are about the fact that they've started these launches, even if they are short range.
David Rennie, let's get to the other piece of that story with regards to the North Korean vessel that was seized. The vessel was reportedly carrying coal illegally in violation of international sanctions. What more do we know about that ship and whether the accounts that we've gotten are verified?
So it's easy to get a bit carried away because you see the missiles being tested and then you hear America has seized a ship and you imagine kind of Navy SEALs kind of rappelling down from a helicopter. It was actually a legal process. This ship had been impounded in Indonesia for many months, and the United States was going through a legal process to have it impounded. And that's what happened. And it's probably a coincidence in terms of timing. It's interesting. This town, Beijing, is full of, among other things, kind of spies and diplomats from all kinds of Asian governments who watch North Korea from here as well as they can. They were quite relaxed yesterday. Their view, I spoke to a couple, was that these missile tests were sort of Kim Jong-un saying, hey, don't forget I'm here. You know, what about me? I'm here and I can make trouble for you, so you better take me seriously. And it's nothing like the mood a year ago where China was genuinely quite upset with the tests that the North Koreans were doing, to the point that the Chinese were pretty openly critical. As far as we can tell, actually, China is pretty content with the way that things are going. And in fact, Xi Jinping could well visit North Korea, which he has not done as president, fairly soon on his way to a summit or on his way back from a summit in Japan. And so there's a sense that actually China thinks things are going its way, and it's probably watching America's discomfort with some satisfaction.
What about the legal aspect of this? I mean, do we know if this ship was actually violating international sanctions? Donald's listening in Kentucky. Donald asked if we know where the coal came from. I mean, are there details of the ship itself that kind of justify the seizure?
So North Korea has been cheating with not just coal transshipments, but and sort of ships that turn off their transponders, which is what this one was caught doing. They've also been doing things like taking oil, little baby oil tankers out to sea and buying oil mid-ocean from Chinese bigger tankers. You know, there's been bits and pieces of smuggling going on all the time. You've seen the Japanese and the Americans flying planes overhead, taking pictures of this, trying to tighten up those sanctions. That's part of this process. And those sanctions remain very, very tight. And certainly the UN sanctions are very tight. And that is making the North Koreans hurt. And that's why you saw in Hanoi, as Courtney said, when the Hanoi talks broke down, that was basically because Kim Jong-un wanted the sanctions lifted in return for very little on the North Korean side. The sanctions are still causing them pain. But the thing, again, that has changed is that a year ago, there was a sense that even China, and remember, China is overwhelmingly the supplier of energy and basically all that North Korea needs to stay alive comes out of China. A year ago, China was so upset with North Korea that they were actually willing to really apply these sanctions quite strictly. The mood has completely changed, and that is because Donald Trump says that he's in love with Kim Jong-un, that he's doing these great talks. That's taken the pressure off everyone else, like the Russians, like the Chinese, who actually are perfectly happy to see North Korea as a kind of slow rumbling problem that causes America headaches. And so that's the effect of Donald Trump's diplomacy, is to take all that sanctions pressure off. So the ship's interesting, but it's not the real momentum. The momentum right now is in the other direction, away from tight sanctions.
So Moises, what does this mean for the U.S.? Is this a strategy shift from Washington? I mean, what does the U.S. gain by doing this, if anything?
So the Trump administration is now getting an education on what it is to deal with North Korea. They are in the same territory that President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton were in dealing with North Korea. They, you know, they have sanctions, and then they promise, make promises, and they want the sanctions lifted, humanitarian aid, and then nothing happens. So we're here. And this is a situation after the Hanoi summit between President Trump and Chairman Sun. The notion, the mood was one of great frustration on both sides, because the United States was essentially offering what they call the Libya model, which is you denuclearize, you give me control over all your nuclear material and technology, and I will lift the sanctions. And that is unacceptable to a tyrant. A tyrant needs to have a nuclear shield and the military capability. And they saw what the Libyan model meant very different things.
Well, and we know what happened to Muammar Gaddafi.
And to the United States. So that's where we are. And they are doing all kinds of things stealthily. They are suffering the consequences of tight sanctions. And again, as you said, and as David said, the role of China has been is now very different from what it was just a year ago.
Before we keep moving from this, Courtney, there was another story that you have out today about President Trump's choice for the new Secretary of Defense, the successor to Jim Mattis. It's Patrick Shanahan, who had been serving as acting defense secretary, and now the president has nominated him to the job more permanently. Tell us more about Patrick Shanahan and his background, who he is.
So he's a career Boeing executive, engineer. He's a, you know, his strengths are in the business side of DOD, which made him a perfect deputy secretary. That tends to be the more admin business side. He knows research and development. He knows some of the big issues that DOD is having to face about, like, supply chain and concerns about China and whatnot. He was perfect for that. Well, then he got sort of thrust into the acting position right before the first of the year when Secretary Mattis resigned, slash, you know, was told to resign by President Trump. So, you know, he's been in this acting role for more than 4 months. Part of the delay has been this IG investigation. The Pentagon Inspector General was looking into whether he was giving favorable to Boeing, favorable business, and at the same time cutting down Lockheed Martin and some of Boeing's competitors. That was unfounded. The allegations were found to be not true. But that happened several weeks ago, and we've still been waiting for a SecDef nom. And so the report that I put out this morning with my colleague Carol Lee, who was on your last hour, actually, was why he was so reluctant, President Trump, and what ultimately pushed him over the edge. You know, I think that Acting Secretary Shanahan, President Trump really wasn't on board with him. He wasn't excited about making him the SecDef. But there was no one else really on bat. Right?
I'm sorry, Secretary of Defense.
There was no one else who was really waiting in the wings to take the job. And in these 4 months, Patrick Shanahan, he didn't have any major gaffes. You know, he was able to sort of keep the trains running. But there was more pressure from the Hill and from retirees, retired military officers and generals, that, you know, an acting Secretary of Defense can only go for so long. He might be able to keep the trains running, but they need someone in there who's actually going to direct where the trains are going. And that was what ultimately President Trump was convinced of and nominated him.
Let's head now to Iran, where tensions escalated this week with the U.S. On Wednesday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani announced that he plans to stop complying with parts of the Iran nuclear deal. He made the statement exactly 1 year after the U.S. pulled out of that deal. David, give us a little bit more on what President Rouhani said. What is it exactly that he's going to stop doing from the deal?
So they're trying to signal that they're very serious about responding to the latest wave of effectively American sanctions, but they're not blowing up the JCPOA. It's a very sort of finely calibrated game that Iran basically wants to keep people like the European Union on side, as keeping the deal alive while signaling that they could blow it up. So a couple of the things that the deal looked at was you have this nuclear reactor that is generating heavy water. At the moment, the deal was that the heavy water would not be enriched to a high level. That would then be exported and sold overseas. Iran has announced it's not going to sell it overseas, so that potentially means it's building up a stockpile. And you're also seeing diplomatically around the side, again, talking to diplomats here in Beijing, the Iranians putting a lot of pressure on the Chinese, on the Europeans, people who buy their oil, to start buying more oil in ways that don't use the US dollar, that essentially kind of bartering for oil, because that's Iran's only hope of selling some of its crude in a way that doesn't trigger American sanctions. Because the big change on the American side was to say that they were never going to renew again the waivers that allowed some oil trading to go on. And so essentially now, if you trade with Iran for oil as a European or as a Chinese or any country, you face American secondary sanctions. And for the moment, that has frozen oil purchases. And it's interesting that even the Chinese, they don't seem to be rushing to Iran's aid to buy a ton of oil in some way that theoretically would escape those U.S. sanctions.
Yeah, Courtney, it almost seems like in some ways this puts more of a spotlight on the U.S. and Europe than on the U.S. and Iran. I mean, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in the U.K. on Wednesday, standing beside his counterpart, the British Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt. They talked about developments in Iran, and both of them promised that they were unified in their efforts to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Here is a bit of what Foreign Minister Hunt said on Wednesday.
Secretary Pompeo and I are at one in agreeing that it will be a massive step back for that region if it became nuclearized. We urge the Iranians to think very long and hard before they break that deal. It is in no one's interest. It is certainly not in their interest, because the moment they go nuclear, their neighbors will as well.
That's British Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt speaking on Wednesday. What does this mean for Europe and the U.S.? Surely neither of them wants this region nuclearized, but there are some competing interests here.
Yeah, part of this whole announcement puts European signatories to the JCPOA in a really tough spot. So
the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal.
Yes. So essentially, President Rouhani announced that drastic measures would be introduced unless the other signatories to the deal, which was Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, I think that's all.
Yeah.
Unless they ease some restrictions on Iran's banking sector, which would, as David said, would potentially open them up to secondary sanctions. So now they have to decide which way are they going to go. Are they going to side with President Trump and withdraw from the agreement? They don't seem likely to do that at this point. Or are they going to face these potential sanctions violations by the United States? So in a way, this is actually forcing those signatories, those nations, to choose sides between the U.S. and Iran, putting them in a tough spot.
By the way, we are keeping an eye on another story from Africa, South Africa's national election. A number of outlets are reporting that the African National Congress currently holds a wide lead with about half the votes counted. The official results due tomorrow. ANC has been in power since 1994 when South Africa elected Nelson Mandela to be president. But support has been waning in recent years because there have been a lot of corruption scandals related to the ANC. Before we move on from Iran, Moises, there was a point you wanted to throw in.
So the Europeans rejected Iran's initiative to get out or reform, change the agreement. And that prompted a reaction by the Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who said that this is an example of the problems facing the attempts to keep this nuclear deal going. He tweeted, the European Union statement is why we are where we are. In a bad situation. The U.S. has bullied Europe and the rest of the world for a year, and the European Union can only express mild regrets. So that tells you that the situation both with the Europeans, with the Iranians, and the Iranians is just as bad, or can become as bad as that of the United States.
And there's also another aspect to this, Courtney. We should note that the U.S. sent military vessels to the Persian Gulf this week in response to what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called specific and credible threats from Iran. Tell us more. Do we know anything about those threats or what they mean in this larger Iran-U.S. standoff?
Yeah, I had a story out this week about one of the threats. So we were repeatedly told this week that it was multiple threat streams. One of those was that the U.S. had intelligence from inside Iran that there was a senior member of the Iranian regime who was directing some of these proxy forces. So we know Iran has these proxies all throughout the region, Shia militias and Hezbollah and the Houthis in Yemen, directing them that they could kind of take the gloves off and they could go after American forces and American interests in the region. So these were existing threats. You know, they were there for a long time. Shia militia groups in Iraq have been there for years, sort of as almost sleeper cells. But the fact that the big Iranian regime was telling them that they could take the gloves off was a very serious threat to the U.S. military, and that caused them to surge these forces. One of the things that they saw immediately after that was actual movement of some of these. So they saw some missiles on Iranian dhows in the Gulf and in the Gulf of Oman. They saw some activity and movement by the militias in outside of Baghdad. So that's led to this. What's particularly interesting is every single day, several times a day, I've been asking the question, has this big show of force and this big pronouncement by the U.S. led to any change? And the answer so far has been no. Iran continues and these proxies continue to move in that direction.
A number of other stories we want to talk about before our time is up, including a story out of Myanmar. Two Reuters reporters are free after more than 500 days behind bars there. Cha So-u and Walon were arrested after investigating the killing of Rohingya men in that country. The men were pardoned with several thousand other prisoners after their appeal to Myanmar's Supreme Court was rejected. Joining us in studio is Reed Wilson, the author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. He's also a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, welcome back.
Hey, Joshua, how are you?
So the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has reached a new record. More than 1,000 people have died since the outbreak began in August. There's been widespread community mistrust, violence against healthcare workers by armed rebel groups. Do we know how the outbreak began back in August?
Yes, the outbreak began with a single woman who had a funeral. She died of the Ebola virus. Her funeral was held in a very small village called Mandima. From there, it spread to a large town of about 250,000 people called Beni. It has since shifted south to two sort of twin cities that collectively have nearly 1 million residents. And this is a very transient region, and this is why this virus has spread across the area. It's a place where people commonly trade, not only between villages and between sort of regional hubs, but also across international borders. This region in the Democratic Republic of the Congo borders Uganda, Rwanda, South Sudan, all places that are susceptible to Ebola itself.
Why are armed groups attacking the healthcare workers?
So this is an area that has been beset by tribal violence and ethnic strife for decades, if not centuries. And they are very disconnected from the federal government in Kinshasa. They don't trust outsiders, basically, because they are more connected to their own local tribal units than they are to anybody else. And what we've seen in recent days is an increase in the mistrust between the communities that are suffering from the Ebola virus and these outsiders who are coming in trying to help them. You can imagine that it's probably pretty scary if somebody shows up in a spacesuit talking about a virus you've never heard of, and by the way, you can't see, with a needle that they want to inject you with a vaccine. If you trust them, that's something that can stop an outbreak. But a lot of people don't trust outsiders, especially not those who come in, you know, scary looking spacesuits.
So based on what these outsiders are doing and offering, if in fact they're doing enough and offering enough, are we looking more at a best case scenario or a worst case scenario for this outbreak?
This is getting closer to the worst case scenario. And that worst case scenario is one in which the virus becomes endemic to the region and continues to spread without hope of actually stopping the outbreak. We've never seen that happen in the past, even in the West Africa outbreak a few years ago. You know, more than 28,000 people were infected, more than 11,000 died. But the good news is the virus was stopped in West Africa. We haven't gotten to that scale yet in Congo, but this is an area that presents basically the most difficult operating environment that public health responders have ever had to deal with.
One other outbreak that we wanted to talk to you about before we let you go. We learned this week that a couple in Mongolia died of the bubonic plague early this month after eating a type of rodent. I thought bubonic plague, black plague, was some medieval illness that disappeared centuries ago.
Well, these illnesses continue to circulate, not just they circulate in part because not everybody's immune system is invulnerable to them. You know, the Spanish flu is more than a century after its massive outbreak across the world still circulates. It's just that more of us are immune to that particular strain than we have been in the past. So bubonic plague has by no means been eradicated throughout the world. It's just that the vast majority of us are never going to come into a circumstance in which we actually get it. And if it ever does infect anybody, they're going to be quarantined pretty quickly.
What about that outbreak? Do we have a sense that one can be contained quickly?
Probably. The bubonic plague, people know how to respond to the bubonic plague a lot better. And by the way, there are, as we talk about sort of the global public health groups that fight these outbreaks, the Chinese have one of the more impressive, basically their version of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the world.
David, I was just going to ask you about that, about whether China has been reacting to this outbreak.
No, so Mongolia has bubonic plague outbreaks pretty much every summer. The last time I was in Mongolia was in the summer, and you get actual sort of military roadblocks on the main road into the capital, Ulaanbaatar, because nomadic herdsmen do collect these rodents, these marmots. They're like a kind of groundhog, and they bring the furs in to sell them in town. And that's a bad idea because there are fleas in the fur of some of these which have the plague. So you literally have military roadblocks to stop nomads coming in. This particular unfortunate couple had eaten some raw marmot flesh, because they thought it would be good for their health, and that was a bad call because they ended up being killed by it.
Reed Wilson of The Hill, his book is called Epidemic, Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks a lot, Joshua.
Let's keep going with the roundup with Moises Naim of El País and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, NBC's Courtney Cuby and David Rennie of The Economist. And let's shift now to Venezuela. Last week, we saw the U.S.-backed opposition leader, Juan Guaido, try to spark an uprising against the government of President Nicolás Maduro. Moises Naim, I definitely want to start with you. You are the most steeped in Venezuela of all of us. You used to be a government minister there. Talk about that uprising, why it failed, and what condition it left Venezuela in this week.
Top officials in the Maduro government have promised U.S. authorities, and especially John Bolton, the national security advisor, that they will turn, that they were going to support the ousting of Nicolas Maduro. And in fact, Nicolas Maduro that day disappeared, was not heard of for 15 hours. And then we were informed, and the world was informed, that Putin intervened, or the Kremlin intervened, and told Maduro that he should not leave. And these officials, which quite significant, they were the Minister of Defense of the country, which is used to be and probably is now again a top a stalwart supporter of Nicolas Maduro, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the General in charge of the Presidential Guard, the head of the intelligence services, they were all part of the plot. And so it's not clear if they were always playing the U.S. Government, or they changed at the last minute under the incentives or threats of other powers. And what we do know is that the Russians are now part of the story in Venezuela, in the same way that they became determinant players in Syria. Now it's impossible to think that you can get an agreement or some sort of outcome without having the Russians sitting at the table.
Just by way of disclosure, Moises, I did mention that you have been involved in the Venezuelan government. Are you viewing the current situation as an outsider? Have you been involved in, you know, talking to the opposition? Where do you stand on this?
I am a member of the opposition, meaning that I don't like the Maduro government, and I have been quite explicit and open and public in my criticism. But I don't belong to any political party or any organized group against the government.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. I do wonder, Moises, what your take is now in terms of the way the world has kind of engaged on this. Cecilia tweeted, could you comment on the situation of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington being taken by Code Pink? How can the U.S. help the legitimate Venezuelan government take possession of their offices? I guess, Moises, that might, depending on who you are and how you view this, depend on your definition of the legitimate Venezuelan government.
Yeah, but again, more than 50 nations, all of them democratic, have recognized Juan Guaido as a legitimate president of Venezuela. So, you know, you don't see that kind of international coalition being formed that quickly and so homogeneously against having a president, Nicolas Maduro, that has usurped power. So that should take care of it.
Courtney, what's your sense of the military situation there? I mean, Maduro has cracked down on the opposition really hard after last week's failed rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of concern, and when we saw the opposition leader standing with a bunch of masked soldiers, and then, of course, when Leopoldo Lopez was there with him, I can understand why there was a thought that perhaps Maduro was going to leave the country, but it actually ended up sort of fizzling. The military didn't rise up en masse and switch sides. You know, from a U.S. military perspective, there's been a lot of bluster about all options are on the table and what could they do. The reality is the only thing that the U.S. military could really do here is be there for the day after Maduro leaves with humanitarian assistance. They can pre-position things in the region, which they have done. They can be ready to help out. They've announced this week that they're moving a U.S. hospital ship, the Comfort, down off the coast, which will really be for citizens, civilians after Maduro leaves, assuming he leaves in a number of weeks. But from an actual, President Trump has made it very clear. He ran on America First. He's not interested in getting in a war in Venezuela, no matter what John Bolton says.
One quick question. Go ahead, Moises. Go ahead.
Just quickly, I think Courtney is absolutely right in everything she stated. And I just want to add that there is a change in U.S. policy towards Venezuela that happened after President Trump had a long conversation with President Putin. After that, he seemed to have softened the idea that Maduro's ousting was a priority. He recognized, he hinted at the fact that Putin may have persuaded him that Maduro is a tough guy and he will not be easily pushed out, and that he probably need to change his posture in Venezuela. And that has implication about the relationship of President Trump and John Bolton, the National Security Council.
Well, there's been a lot of very heavy news this week, but we would be remiss if we ended without reminding us, ourselves, of the one really positive news story that happened this week that got a lot of people's attention. It's the new baby boy in the royal family who was born on Monday. As promised, 2 days later, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex introduced their son to the world. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle did. They also announced his name on Wednesday. He is named Archie Harrison Mountbatten Windsor.
Love it.
Archie, not Archibald, because, you know, more casual. But their happy postpartum bubble was popped very soon after the birth. Yesterday, the BBC fired a radio presenter named Danny Baker after he tweeted a photo of a couple holding hands with a chimp. The caption was, "Royal Baby Leaves Hospital." Baker insisted that his tweet was not racist and that his joke was misinterpreted. We had a conversation earlier this week, not only about the royal baby, but about raising biracial children. And you'll find that conversation online at the1a.org. David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Courtney Kuby, National Security and Military Reporter for NBC News. Thanks, Courtney.
Thanks for having me.
And Moises Naim of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Chief International Columnist at El País. Thanks, Moises.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.